Welcome to another episode of Insight. I am Ali, and this week, we weren't actually planning on releasing an episode this week, hence the lateness, but my co-host, who is one of my favourite people, he and I got talking about a case we are talking about today, and before we knew it, we had an episode. This week's co-host is my dear boyfriend, Rob. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Now, Rob is developing two podcasts as we speak. The first one is not true crime, but a retro wrestling type podcast. For anyone like me who still daydreams of the 1980s or 1990s pro wrestling, I will post links in the Facebook group once the podcast is launched. The second podcast is with me. It's a horror movie retrospective podcast. It'll be called Horror Never Sleeps, and we're hoping to launch it next month. And again, stay tuned in the Facebook group for details once the podcast is launched. Today's case is one that was linked to a well-known serial killer in the 1960s and 1970s California. Her case is mentioned whenever the Zodiac Killer is, however, the two have never formally been confirmed. He claimed her murder, saying he was responsible, but the official line from investigators is simply, "We don't know for sure." Today's case is a 1966 unsolved murder of 18-year-old college student Sherry Jo Bates. Sherry Josephine Bates was born in Omaha on February 4, 1948. In 1966, where our story takes place, Sherry had only just graduated from Ramona High School, where she was a cheerleader and an honors student, and she had started Riverside City College that fall. She wanted to work as an airline stewardess once she finished college. Sherry worked part-time at Riverside National Bank, which helped her buy and pay for her own car, a lime green Volkswagen, something that she was very proud of achieving. It was a big deal for an 18-year-old student at the time. It kind of still is today, really. She also had a boyfriend that she was seeing for about 2 years, Dennis Highland. He had gone to Riverside City College, but had transferred that year to San Francisco State College, and that is about 6 or 7 hours away. He transferred on a football scholarship, something that Sherry fully supported. The week before our story takes place, Sherry actually went to San Francisco with Dennis's parents to visit him, and they watched him play a football game. They were both deeply in love, so much so that they had recently got engaged. On Sunday, October 30, 1966, the day started like any other day for 18-year-old Sherry Jo Bates. That morning, Sherry went to Mass with her father, Joseph Bates, at the St. Catherine's Catholic Church. The two then had breakfast afterwards at Sandy's restaurant. Joseph tried to convince his daughter to go to the beach with him. Despite it being late October, the weather was still quite warm. It was the perfect beach day. Sherry declined the offer, though. She had a research paper she was working on for college, and she really wanted to spend some time doing that.
After her father left, Sherry called a friend Stephanie to see if she wanted to go to the Riverside City College Library Annex with her to study. Stephanie had other plans and said no. Sherry, being the good student wanting to make a good impression early in the school year, decided to go anyway. She worked at home until about 4:30 to 5 p.m. when she left a note for her father taped to the refrigerator which read, "Dad, went to the RCC library," and then she left. According to a witness report, we can assume that she got to the library about 5:30 p.m. The library didn't open until 6 p.m. Another student got there about the same time and he was waiting at the front. He saw Sherry there. Sherry also called a friend about 5:30 p.m. because she couldn't find a term paper. The two talked for a while. I'm going to assume here that Sherry called from a payphone, only because we know she wasn't at home because her father had gotten home at 5 p.m. and Sherry wasn't there. Another thing we can assume is that she entered the library because she checked out the books there and they were later found in her car. It is reported that she stayed until close, which was 9 p.m. But there is some contention, which we'll get to later. When she left, she would have headed out to the parking lot where her lime green Volkswagen car was parked, which was behind some old houses owned by the college that were used for dormitories. We can assume she entered the library because three books were checked out and they were later found in her car. It is reported that she stayed until close, which was 9 p.m. But there is some contention about that, and we'll get to that later on. When she left, she would have headed out to the parking lot where her lime green Volkswagen car was parked, which was behind some old houses owned by the college that were used as dormitories.
Joseph Bates returns home for the night around midnight, and he realises his daughter hasn't returned home. And a note that he left her hadn't been touched either, so he knew she hadn't come home at all that night. But he just assumes that she's staying at a friend's house and he goes to bed. When Joseph wakes up at 5:45 the next morning, he realises Sherry hasn't come home at all, so he contacts the police and reports his daughter missing. Only about an hour later, about 6:30, a groundskeeper is doing his daily routine and he finds a body face down in a dirt driveway between two empty houses that the college owns. So the police are immediately called. Her bag was nearby, so she didn't appear to have been a victim of a robbery. So the police were able to identify her based on the papers in her bag. This woman was Sherry Jo Bates. At the scene, police found a paint-stained men's Timex watch with a broken band which suggested that the owner had a wrist about 7 inches based on the natural wear and tear of the band. Investigators believe the watch was ripped off the killer's arm during the attack, and in the rush to leave the scene, he either couldn't find it or he simply forgot about it. The watch showed the time as 12:24, but later autopsy results believe that Sherry died only a few hours prior to this, and very quickly, if that is any consolation. The watch was later traced back to a military post, most likely in England. They also found a shoe print, size 8 to 10 men's shoe, and it was a military-style heel. It's the belief of the investigators the shoe came from the nearby March Air Force Base. And they also found fingerprints and a palm print that didn't belong to Sherry on her car. Her friends and family were also checked, and the prints didn't belong to them either. You're going to spend a third of your life wrapped up in your sheets. So are they taking care of you the way they should be? At Brooklinen.com, you get high-quality sheets and bedding that you deserve at an accessible price. Brooklinen was founded in April 2014 by a husband and wife team. They have a simple philosophy, and that is we deserve simple, beautiful home essentials, but without the luxury price. Most high-end bedding is marked up by 300% by the time it reaches the store. Brooklinen cuts out unnecessary markups and manufacturing waste in order to offer exquisite designs and exceptional savings across their whole collection. This is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. My Brooklinen sheets are definitely the best sheets I've ever slept in. I love mine, and I know that you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for Insight listeners. Get $20 off with free shipping when you use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident that you will love your new sheets. They offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There is no reason not to give these sheets a try. The only way to get $20 off with free shipping is to use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. That's BROOKLINEN.com, promo code SITE. Brooklinen. These are the best sheets ever.
Her car was also found 200 feet or about 60 metres away from where her body was. The keys were still in the ignition, the windows were down, and the books and reading material for college were on the passenger seat. The car had been tampered with the middle wire of the distributor disconnected, which would have caused her battery to drain, therefore meaning Sherry wouldn't be able to start her car and leave. An autopsy was conducted. The autopsy found that she was beaten. There was evidence of manual strangulation. Her throat was deeply slashed, which was believed to have caused her death. And there were stab wounds to her back and face. She was stabbed a total of 11 times, 7 of which nearly decapitated her. It is the belief the knife was only very small, something like 3.5 inches long. Underneath the fingernails was skin tissue, meaning that she fought back against her attacker. And there were 4 brown hairs in a blood clot in her hand, presumably from her attacker as well. Her body was fully clothed and there was no evidence that she was sexually assaulted in any way. The investigators believe that Sherry was somehow lured into the alleyway or driveway, possibly related to her car not working. Maybe it was someone she knew, that we don't know for sure. For whatever reason, the two stayed there for about an hour and a half based on the assumed time of death, and that's when she was assaulted and murdered.
And this timeline fit in with some witness statements from local residents that was soon called into the police. That these witnesses heard screams in the campus area at approximately 10:15 to 10:45. One of these witnesses also remembers hearing what they describe as an old car starting soon after the screams. So the detectives start their investigation. They go to the most logical place, the library where she was last seen. 2 weeks after the murder, they do a reconstruction, and they ask everyone who was there that night if anyone saw her, or if she was with anyone, or if there was anyone strange around the library that they didn't recognise. And we're talking about more than 60 people here, some of them being Sherry's friends, but no one remembers seeing Sherry at the library that night at all. It was a very thorough reconstruction. Only two people, a man and a woman, they didn't attend the reconstruction. I couldn't find any more information than this, but I assume that the police did question those people. Within the first day or two of the investigation, police interview something like 75 people. They check out the alibis of men at the nearby military base, as well as Sherry's fellow students and teachers. Police look into the most obvious leads, any boyfriends that she may have now or in the past. Dennis Highland was interviewed and he was considered a suspect but was quickly cleared. At the time of the murder, he had a solid alibi. He was in school in San Francisco and was seen throughout the night there. So police have no leads, they have no witnesses, and any evidence they did have, it didn't lead them anywhere. Now this was long before electronic databases and everything was kept on paper files. So it took longer and it was more difficult to cross-check the information. But no one on their records matched the fingerprints or blood analysis that was found on the crime scene. So the case, it quickly goes cold. And then a month later, on November 29, 1966, two identical letters were sent to the Riverside Police and the Riverside Press Enterprise newspaper by someone claiming to be responsible for killing Sherry. This letter read,
"She was young and beautiful, but now she is battered and dead. She is not the first victim and she will not be the last. I lay awake nights thinking about my next victim. Maybe she'll be the beautiful blonde that babysits near the little store and walks down the dark alley each evening about 7. Or maybe she'll be the shapely blue-eyed brunette that said no when I asked her for a date in high school. But maybe it will not be either. But I shall cut off her female parts and deposit them for the whole city to see. So don't make it too easy for me. Keep your sisters, daughters, and wives off the streets and alleys. Miss Bates was stupid. She went to the slaughter like a lamb. She did not put up a struggle. But I did. It was a ball. I first pulled out the middle wire from the distributor. Then I waited for her in the library and followed her out after 2 minutes. The battery must have been about dead by then. I then offered to help. She was then very willing to talk with me. I told her my car was down the street and I could give her a lift home. When we were away from the library walking, I said it was about time. She asked me, 'About time for what?' I said it was about time for her to die. I grabbed her around the neck with my hand over her mouth and my other hand with a small knife at her throat. She went very willingly. Her breast felt very warm and firm under my hands. But only one thing was on my mind, making her pay for the brush-offs that she had given me during the years prior. She died hard. She squirmed and shook as I choked her, and her lips twitched. She let out a scream once and I kicked her head to shut her up. I plunged the knife into her and it broke. I then finished the job by cutting her throat. I am not sick, I am insane, but that will not stop the game. This letter should be published for all to read. It might just save the girl in the alley, but that's up to you. It will be your conscience, not mine. Yes, I did make that call to you also. It was just a warning. Beware. I am stalking your girls now."
Now, how authentic this letter is, it's never been determined. But the writer did offer some facts that were only known to police, such as the middle wire being tampered with and the call to the police. The letters were postmarked Riverside but didn't have a stamp attached. The letter was typewritten, so handwriting analysis wasn't an option. Now, there are a few contradictions in the letter. He says she wasn't the first, and we will talk more about that in a moment, but the fact he left his watch behind, which could very well identify him, the fact he could have gotten the crime over with a lot quicker without the chance of being caught because, honestly, he was between two houses. There was every chance that he could have been seen. He also stated in the letter that she didn't put up a struggle, but the crime scene suggests otherwise. The broken watch, the skin under the fingernails, even the police report states that the ground was churned up and it looked like there was a struggle. All of this indicates to me that not only did she put up a struggle, but she came close to overpowering him. I would imagine that this is something the killer wouldn't like to admit. He wouldn't have realised how strong a teenage girl with her adrenaline pumping could be, and it nearly cost him everything. That was a mistake I think he wouldn't make again if it was someone who went on to kill again. But we'll talk more about that later. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Finding great talent can be tough. Thankfully, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100+ job sites with just one click. Then their powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job, better than anyone else. That's what makes ZipRecruiter different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't rely on job candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter find a quality job candidate in just 24 hours. There's no juggling of emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place. With ZipRecruiter easy-to-use dashboard, find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. Right now, Insight listeners can post jobs to ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ziprecruiter.com/site. That's ziprecruiter.com/site. One more time, to try it for free, go to ziprecruiter.com/site.
In December of 1966, in the same college library that Sherry was last seen, a morbid poem was scratched into the surface of one of the desks. The poem read, "Sick of living, unwilling to die, cut, clean, if red, I clean, blood spurting, dripping, spilling, all over her new dress. Oh well, life draining into an uncertain death, she won't die this time, someone find her, just wait till next time, R.H." Now, I did find an article of someone who was found dead in a similar manner not far from where Sherry was. She was found December 19 of 1966, so not quite 2 months after Sherry. She was found by a hunter in the underbrush of a cliff. She was wearing a red dress. There was no identification found on the body, and Jane Doe didn't match any missing person's report of anyone who was missing. She was badly decomposed, so she would have been killed before Sherry. The investigators estimate that she was killed 3 or 4 months before she was found. So if we are looking at the original letter stating that Sherry was not the first and won't be the last, then this fits in. No new leads, and the police have nothing that gives them any idea of who they are looking for. And then on April 30th, 1967, three letters were received. They were double stamped, sent from Riverside, and were handwritten. They were sent to the Riverside Press newspaper, the police, and Sherry's father. Two are the same, they said. Bates had to die, there will be more. And at the bottom of the page is a symbol that many believe to be the letter Z, and the reasons for that we'll get to in a bit. And the letter to her father read, "She had to die, there will be more." Again, like the first letter, it didn't lead anywhere. There was nothing to identify the author, no fingerprints, nothing.
It wouldn't be until early 1968 that police found what they considered to be a strong suspect to Sherry's murder. An informant comes forward to the Riverside Police Department and tells them that Sherry wasn't exactly loyal to her boyfriend, and she'd been seeing someone for a few weeks before her murder. And this man, whose name has never been released to the public, he was heard bragging about killing Sherry. Now, this informant was in prison at the time, but he was given a polygraph and he passed. Also, his story, it's remained consistent over time. This man went to high school with Sherry and he started college with her. Sherry mentions him in her diary and their relationship, so that part backs up the informant's story. Their relationship ended when Sherry returned from San Francisco and she tells this guy that she accepted her boyfriend's marriage proposal, and this was about a week before her murder. But he doesn't take this well. A few days before the murder, this guy and Sherry come across each other on campus and they get into a heated argument. The guy allegedly slapped Sherry and asked her if she changed her mind yet. The night Sherry was killed, the man was playing basketball in the afternoon with his friends. Apparently Sherry calls him and they have a short conversation. He tells his friends that, quote unquote, that bitch is going to the library. Another friend comes forward and says the suspect had came to him, he was crying and saying that he, quote unquote, had snuffed Sherry. He too was given a polygraph and he passed. And then at 1:30 a.m. on October 31st, so we're talking just hours after Sherry was murdered, residents in the area reported seeing two men walking around with flashlights as if they were looking for something. These people stuck around for about 15 minutes before they left. This leads the police to believe that their suspect is working with a friend, that he had an accomplice. The investigators call their suspect and his friend in for a polygraph. Now the suspect refuses, and the friend, while he agreed at first, he did answer the questions, but when the questions started to discuss Sherry's murder, he refused to answer. The suspect eventually did agree to take the polygraph, and he passed on questions surrounding him being the one that murdered Sherry, but it came back as inconclusive when questions surrounded did he know what happened to Sherry, and did he know who was responsible for killing her. By the time they got the original warrant to test his DNA with the tissue found under Sherry's fingernails, it was thought the sample was too decomposed to test. But then in December of 1998, it happened, and the DNA came back as a conclusive non-match, and the former lover of Sherry's was officially removed as a suspect in her murder.
In October of 1969, the police started considering whether Sherry could have been killed by the Zodiac Killer. Now, we aren't going to go into great detail on who and what the Zodiac Killer is, because this is Sherry's story. In the Zodiac story, if you're interested, The Apex and The Abyss did a great job covering this case recently. But just the basics, the Zodiac was a serial killer who operated in Northern California, not overly far from where Sherry was murdered, in the late 1960s and early 1970s. It has been confirmed that the Zodiac killed 5 people, 3 women and 2 men. But he claimed to have killed many others. He named himself the Zodiac in a series of letters he sent to the police, taunting them, not unlike those sent in Sherry's case. But in the case of the Zodiac, these letters included 4 cryptograms which only one has ever been solved. The Zodiac was never caught, but police believed Sherry could have been his first murder, or at least one of the early murders of the Zodiac. This was further supported when handwriting analysis of the poem written on the desk at the college Sherry was at before she died and letters from the Zodiac were compared, and the handwriting came up a match. The media quickly got word of this, and by November 1970, both the San Francisco Chronicle and the New York Times published lengthy articles about the connection. And then on March 13, 1971, the Zodiac sent a letter to the New York Times claiming that he killed Sherry Jo Bates. There's much debate about the truth written in these letters and if he actually had any connection at all.
Something that makes me question whether this was actually the work of the Zodiac was, remember, the Zodiac didn't mention being responsible for Sherry's murder until after all the 1968 and 1969 murders. And he didn't mention it until after the media leaked the police were considering the link between Sherry and the Zodiac murders. And when the Zodiac wrote to the papers for the first time, he wrote about killing the 2 teenagers before Christmas and then the girl on the 4th of July. But he doesn't mention, oh, you know what, and that girl in Riverside 3 years ago. So maybe he didn't kill her and he knew nothing about Sherry's murder until after he read about the connection. Or maybe he did kill her, but didn't say anything before because Riverside is so far away from the places he did the other killings. And he figured that the police wouldn't even know which murder he was referring to if he mentioned Sherry. Also, another tick in the Not the Zodiac column was when he wrote on Brian Hartnell's car door after the Berryessa attack. Again, he only made note of the two other murders, the Christmas and the 4th of July ones. Again, he didn't mention Sherry. Finally, another thing that makes me think it's not the Zodiac is when he mentions in the original letter that he was going to dispose of her lady parts and he talks about Sherry's breasts, there was never any evidence that the Zodiac did anything sexual with any of his victims or thought of them as being sexual beings. The writer of the original letter, he does make it sound like he had some, possibly some sexual issues. The only thing I think that firmly place a tick in the Zodiac column is the poem that was carved into the desk at her college. The handwriting was analysed and it was deemed a match to that of the Zodiac letters. And I guess the second possible yes, it was the Zodiac, could be the military connection. Because we do have the shoe prints, the watch. In the Zodiac cases, there's the haircut, the military-style glasses, the military jargon he used in his letters. All that does point to a military background. I know that's not indefinite proof that it is the Zodiac that killed Sherry, but there is a connection. I don't know, it doesn't prove anything to me though.
Another theory that is mentioned by author of the Zodiac Files, Raymond Grant. His theory revolves around Sherry being abducted by more than one person before she even went to the library, and that her books were checked out using her card, but by someone else. That could be why no one saw her, and it would misdirect the police into thinking she was in one place when in fact she never was. Another theory along those lines is that Sherry was approached by an unwanted admirer, planning to enter the library to check out her reading material. The admirer insisted on accompanying her. However, Sherry was not wanting to be seen with this man, asked him not to get the library books on her behalf. Again, uncomfortable at being spotted with this man, suggested a second location nearby to talk to him. As the hours passed, she eventually makes her excuses to return to her vehicle and go home. The library was now shut and she feels safe that nobody will see her with this man. She rolls down the window, places the key in the ignition, but her admirer makes unwanted advances that escalate. Fearing the situation has got out of hand, she races from the car towards the parking area to seek help and things turn violent in the driveway. The problem here, however, is that we would have to assume that he was able to check out the books from the library using female identification and not be questioned. And furthermore, he would have to have disabled the car after the attack and thereby creating confusion as to how the crime occurred. Not very likely.
And finally, it is mentioned on one website that four workmen did see Sherry return to her car at around 7 p.m. That she put her books in the car, but she didn't leave. They report they didn't see anyone with her. The problem with this theory is, where did she go? Even at this time, we're looking at a 2 to 3 hour window until she's killed. What happened? Now this theory does lend to the fact to me that she knew her killer, but why didn't anyone see her with anyone?
To have that much time unaccounted for, after she was last seen leaving the library or by her car, at 7, 7:15, 7:30, anywhere around that time. You'd assume that in the 60 metres from her car to where she was found, it's just way too much time for someone not to have seen her if she was sitting at a park, sitting on the ground with someone, or really just anywhere around that area, because people were still walking by. That alleyway was used quite a bit. There was a report by somebody that was there at about 9:30 and this female student, I believe, saw a man that was there smoking in the laneway.
And I did read that too, and that she didn't see any evidence of an attack or a murder in the alleyway. However, 9:30 at night, you imagine it would be quite dark. Even if she did have a good look up the alleyway, there's no guarantee she saw Sherry there. She could have mistaken Sherry for a bush. There was a lot of trees in the alleyway. There's no guarantee she actually would have seen anything, even if she was looking.
One of the most difficult elements of this case is whether you believe the confession letter that was written to the police about the murder. Because there's a lot of information there that Because if you believe that, and there is quite a bit there to go on, then it gives you more details, or at least reading between the lines. In that letter, the confession, there wasn't a mention of spending a long period of time after she'd left the library. It seemed to happen pretty suddenly, which would indicate that perhaps...
So if you're saying the confession letter is correct, that would support another scenario where that she stayed at the library till close, somehow her friends didn't see her there, she left, she got to her car wouldn't start, her murderers come up, offered to help her, they tinker around with the car for a bit, then they walk towards his car where he then attacks her and kills her, like he says in the letter. But if that is correct, I do find it unlikely that 60-plus people didn't see Sherry in a small library when by all accounts, she was a very popular, outgoing, friendly girl. She was very beautiful. I think someone would have seen her if she was there for 3 hours at the library.
There are conflicting reports and theories about the watch that was found, the Timex watch. Originally in the reports, it has it stated that the watch... when it was photographed, was of 12:23 or 12:24. It's very difficult to know for sure if the watch was stopped or not at the time because of, obviously, so much time has gone by.
And there is a second photo online that shows what looks like a crime scene photo with the watch showing 9:07. I will put both those photos up on the Facebook group so you can have a look for yourselves, but one looks like a crime scene photo, the 9:07. The other one looks like it was taken at the police station as evidence, and that's the one that shows 12:24.
The library closed at 9 p.m, so when you put the timeline into place, she was parked pretty close to it. Probably would have only taken a minute or so to get to her car from the library. And the watch that was found at the crime scene was believed to have come off of the killer in the struggle. In one of the photos at the crime scene, the watch looks like it stopped at 9:07. If this is 9:07 p.m. and the watch did stop at that time, then this gives a pretty concise time frame. 7 minutes, perhaps she left a couple of minutes earlier than 9 before it closed, for the walk to the car, the 2 minutes that it says in the confession letter to try the car, 60 seconds, maybe even a couple of minutes to ask somebody for help, and then to make her way to the alleyway where she's attacked.
I find that more believable because her keys were found in the car, the windows were left down. I find it more believable that she had gotten help to start the car and walked off with the person to his car, and that's when she was attacked. It's more realistic than thinking that she left her car unlocked, left the keys in there, and then went off with someone for 3 hours and then was killed. I guess something to remember, there was a number of serial killers working in and out of California in the 1960s and 1970s. We know many of them, but there are others that we probably don't know about. There was quite a bit of overlap when it comes to MO and the area of the murders. Because of that and the length of time since Sherry's murder, there's a good chance the killer has since passed away, and the more and more time that passes, the more likely anyone who does know anything will also take their secrets with them. I hope that I'm wrong, but I can't see this murder ever being solved at this point.
To me, this is one of the greatest tragedies about the whole case. There's the loss of a life of a beautiful girl that was just starting her life and that was so popular. Unfortunately, she will be remembered for the way that she died. And not only that, but she will also be synonymous with the Zodiac. I personally don't see the relevance, even if you were to deduce that the Zodiac did kill her. It still begs the question. Who is the Zodiac? Now, crimes are solved based on evidence. When you look at the Zodiac's story, all of his crimes, all of his letters, his MO, everything, it just leaves so many more questions. It begs more questions that it gives answers to. In terms of Sherry Jo Bates, I think that her story is far beyond a folklore or far beyond that of just a serial killer. Sherry Jo may have been killed by the Zodiac Killer or may not have been. Either way, what is there to gain by knowing? Either way, what is there to gain by the link? If the Zodiac did kill Sherry, his description did change quite dramatically from witnesses that saw him. Facially, the account seemed to be pretty close and pretty reliable, but his height and weight did differ among witnesses. So essentially, unless you're looking at yearbook photos and people that Sherry Jo knew, photos of them, unless they look like the Zodiac, then perhaps you have a case there.
As far as the Zodiac killer connection goes, I've never been, and I'm still not 100% convinced that Sherry was a Zodiac victim. Like most serial killers, I think many people try to link as many unsolved crimes to the Zodiac, and to me, some of them are real stretches. However, I do consider Sherry to be one of the most realistic attempts to connect the Zodiac. It seems to me that this could very well have shown some of the hallmarks of his crimes when he was still in the early stages of his murderous career. And then the symbols on the cars and the scary costumes, that could all be effects added later for greater dramatic flair. Okay, so some thank yous. Firstly, to our patrons on Patreon. Thank you to Andrew J, Christina M, Alice, Heather P, and Julia L. Your support means everything. And just a bit of an update of our Patreon shoutouts. Charlie and I are horribly behind, so please don't think we have missed giving you a shout-out. We're only just now giving shout-outs to patrons starting in May, but we're determined to catch up. And then to our beautiful 5-star reviews. Thank you to Kate Ez 1989, Eleanor Go, M Brown Sugar, SN Route 90, Mimi 123554443, and Karen Jett. I know that iTunes does not make it easy to leave reviews, but we really appreciate it. We are on Facebook. We have the page where we post all our episodes and discussion group, which is exactly that. It's a private group where we discuss episodes, documentaries, other podcasts we listen to, and any other case that anyone is interested in. We are on Twitter, where you can chat to Charlie, and that's at InsightfulPod. I post photos on Instagram, and that's at InsightPod. And we both respond to the emails, insightfulpod@gmail.com. We have a PayPal for a one-off donation, and a Patreon for an ongoing monthly donation. On Patreon, we have some great rewards for our patrons, like a monthly bonus episode, stickers, magnets, t-shirts, and a lovely thank you card from Charlie. All links are on our website, insightpod.com, and you can also listen to our episodes there and read all our show notes and access some additional research if you want to read up some more on the cases we talk about here. And finally, it would mean the world to us if you would rate, review and subscribe on iTunes or your favourite podcast app. It does give us a bump up the charts and brings more people to the podcast.